This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's the final working day of the week. It is your Friday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Welcome to it. My name is Arabile Gumede. Nastasia Aronsa here with us again.
Yes, it's really good to be with you, except you'll notice next week when you listen, the script is going to change slightly because a certain individual, I won't mention who, might be out of town.
Do I sense a bit of jealousy there?
A little.
Oh, okay. I'll bring you something nice if I can.
With the euro, yeah, good luck.
Yeah, that is going to be a big problem, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, certainly an interesting show ahead. However, Friday edition of today's show is going to focus a lot on healthcare. We hopefully will chat to the health minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi. Of course, the NHI bill being gazetted yesterday. Big, big news from a national standpoint. How do we afford it? You know, besides just the difficulty in understanding just how complex the bill itself is going to be, we'll get in touch with him and hopefully get a chat on just how exactly he plans to, one, fund this, and how he hopes to get this around the country as well, and how soon we can get it steamrolling. It's been a plan for quite some time as well.
Right. And then we're going to talk to Graham Anderson, who's the CEO of ProfMed, rather, on the same issue on the NHI. And it's expected that there'll be some heated debate with private sector providers over what is a fair rate for their services. So that is likely to be a very interesting conversation.
Yeah. And we also then get to chat about introducing virtual reality curriculums to learners, just how and what that means. So essentially, are we able to add a different sense of learning to pupils and make it perhaps a little easier, and just how exactly we can get that sort of going. Addie Stephen, who's the head of learning at IQ Business, will be joining us in studio as well.
All this and more is coming up.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
The market indicators are brought to you by Verify, an online search engine that provides you with a comprehensive report of your policies and investments. Let's take a quick look at the markets. It was a little bit here and a little bit there everywhere for the local exchanges, with the JSE itself going up and down and not really sure where it would close by the end of trade. But at 56,234 is where the all share ended yesterday. It was, however, a fairly negative day out in the United States, as the Dow Jones Industrial ended the day 0.8% lower, 24,461 points. The S&P 500 at 2,749, also down 0.2% there. Having seen the Nasdaq finish at an all-time high, that's 21 days of all-time highs this year so far. Yesterday, however, it got a backlash, 0.8% down, 7,712 points. The FTSE 100, the DAX and the CAC 40 all down around 1% or more yesterday as well. So the European market's not faring well. But this morning we're seeing the Nikkei down 1% as well. The Shanghai Composite is the only one reaching high out in China, 0.3% to the good, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index is down 0.25%, 29,217 points. Over into your commodity front now. $1,267 a fine ounce is the price of gold. Brent platinum will set you back $858. It's down 0.3% today, with Brent crude edging a little lower, 73.14 this morning. Quick look at your currencies as well then. It'll cost you R13.56 for a US dollar. It's R17.98 for a British pound. And a euro will set you back R15.74. It's US dollars rather, for a Bitcoin, 93,402 rand for the same Bitcoin as well. Your market indicators brought to you by Verify, an online search engine providing you with a comprehensive report of your policies and investments.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's just gone 9 minutes after seven, and I'm joined in studio by Gary Boyson, who's a portfolio manager at Rand Swiss. If you're in studio right now, you'd see that he's wearing a jersey that I'm pretty sure is symbolic of what we've been seeing in the markets this whole week. It is bright red, and you certainly won't miss him. And I've tweeted a picture, so if you do follow any one of us, you can have a look at that. But Gary, thanks so much for your time this morning. Let's have a look back at yesterday's markets performance. What was your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so again, a little bit of pain coming through, you know, the local markets, international markets as well. So, yeah, maybe subconsciously dressing myself accordingly. Yeah. But, yeah, looking at it again, it's really a global macro story that is playing out, and it's the concerns about the rising trade war, and what that means. And you know, if you kind of look at most of the economics behind it, you know, people are scared that this is potentially going to influence the overall global trade level. But a lot of data is saying that it might not be the overall trade level that is influenced, but actually just how trade, the distribution of trade, so how trade is allocated between companies, where final products come from. But it certainly gives rise to a lot of uncertainty. So we saw on Wednesday as well, Fed Chair Jerome Powell saying that they're starting to see that businesses are going to delay investment decisions because of the uncertainty around trade policy. And now that is very, very concerning for the global economy, because that will drop the overall level of trade. And that seems to be playing out in the markets, and the nerves certainly, the jitters feeding through, and things on the back foot.
Looking back at the week that was, key standout events or company news for you?
Oh, I think there was certainly, those Brait numbers didn't look great. I think that's what everyone was talking about this week, definitely. And, just again, a little bit of concerns around, companies making big loans to their management. But again, the real story behind Brait is actually the investment in New Look, which is under an enormous amount of pressure, partly because of, I suppose, a miss on the apparel range that they're trying to sell into the UK, partly because of just the way that they were pricing it. But that really accounting for the majority of the impairments of the company, and I think most of the share price pain.
Another piece of information that everyone was talking about was Dis-Chem, and that's because its CFO had used slightly more than, I think, 4.1 million of his shares to enter into an off-market hedge. And there was a tweet out of RECM Chairman Pete Viljoen saying, "Directors of Dis-Chem hedging exposure to their own shares, not a good sign for this highly priced market darling." When is it a good time? Is it ever okay? Not even a good time. Is it ever okay for a company director to bet against his own stock? Like, how does that work? Explain that.
So it's a good question. So again, you want to try and avoid the principal agent problem. So you would like your company directors to obviously have a stake in the business, and certainly if it should be a conflict of interest that. If you're betting that your own share is going to fall, and you're in a position in which you're making business decisions, that just logically doesn't make any sense. But you're looking at it, companies, the market will value a company where the market values a company as well. And I mean, often, you see, especially listed investment vehicles, they'll trade at huge premiums to their underlying net asset value, and the company will come out with a rights issue. Now, essentially, it's saying, if you guys are wanting to give us money at this price, we'll take it. And if the Dis-Chem, if Dis-Chem see, they think that potentially the stock is overvalued, taking out a short position, I mean, it's certainly sending signals to the market, and I think that's what Pete Viljoen is picking up on. It's saying that the stock is perhaps a little bit overvalued at these levels.
But David Shapiro raised an interesting point. He says, why don't you just sell some of your shares?
Well, often directors have lock-in periods. They have reasons, in the contractually that they can't necessarily exit the underlying script, so they do an overlay hedge. So they'll go and take a, either a futures contract or some sort of other contract against the position, so that they don't have to, technically unwind the underlying position. And also there would be capital gains concerns, all sorts of things that, if you see share price weakness in the short term, you might choose not to unwind the underlying position and are just protecting yourself against, some short-term movement. Again, the question comes is this is fine for a standard investor, but, when you're in the position to make decisions on behalf of the company, it certainly calls into question, corporate governance.
And then we had Murray and Roberts this week. What did you make of the developments? And, I mean, we've been watching it for some time now, and depending on which side you were on, it didn't really work out the way I thought it would. But, there's still some room to go. It's not over yet. But what did you make of what happened this week?
So again, it's interesting because you look at the listed construction space, and I mean, it's an incredibly difficult area to operate in. And I mean, end of last week, we saw the implosion of Basil Reed. Yeah. And, we now look at Murray and Roberts, potentially, buying out of Inch, and I mean, getting the go-ahead, essentially, with some limitation. You know, they didn't get the full application through to the Competition Tribunal to block Eitan's entire voting rights, which for me is just also a very, very strange concept that, you know, as a shareholder, you can't exercise the majority vote in your own shares. But, they did manage to, I suppose, get a stay of execution on that deal. And it does look like there's support for the purchasing of Avenge. If you look at the sell side commentary around it, many people criticizing that Avenge Murray's deal as Murray and Roberts shareholders essentially bailing out Avenge credit holders. So essentially Avenge, in huge, and a huge liquidity pressure. And, you can clearly see the benefit of the deal for Avenge in that they desperately need Marion Roberts' balance sheet. Mm. But how that's going to play out, I think, the story's far from over.
All right, that's Gary Boyson, who's a portfolio manager at Rand Swiss. He'll still be sticking around a little bit longer with us to have a conversation. Stay tuned.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Well, if there's one sector of the economy that we're hoping continues to flourish, it's tourism. Of course, you see the likes of Russia and the like as well, just keeping up with how things are going. That's particularly because of events like the World Cup. But in South Africa, we need to try and keep ourselves on the up as well. But how do we do that in a time when things have gone relatively negatively as well? We aren't seeing an economy that is able to have as much tourism as it would like. Stats SA on Monday releasing their tourism and migration figures, presenting a really bad story as well. A decrease in tourism arrivals in South Africa. March saw 3,560,000 arrivals. That's compared to 3.8 million in April 2017. So that's a year-on-year change. The figures reflect an almost 7% decline in foreign arrivals. Sonwabile Henama, Tshwane University of Technology, joining us on the line. Sonwabile, thank you so much for your time. It's a bad image for of course South Africa to have, but is there anything specific that we're doing wrong?
Good morning, sir, and good morning to all of the listeners on Classic Business. I believe first and foremost this could be prevented. We have arrived at the destination where for many, many years we have been acting in an appropriate manner, because for the past 2 years the visa issue has been the most important topic that the National Department of Tourism and Home Affairs were supposed to resolve. So 2 years later, they have not resolved this thing which could have created so many jobs. And now the decline in the tourism sector is a specific reflection on that inability to find a political solution.
And is there political will then? We speak about finding a political solution, but how about, is government playing its part then in that sense of trying to at least come to the table and having the conversation, despite the fact that they don't agree on everything?
Well, Arabil, it's 2 years later. If it was 6 months ago, then I would say, okay, let's give government an opportunity. So this is more than 24 months later, so there is no political will. Because remember, even Minister Dedekanekom and Mr. Malusi were retaken back to their previous ministries where they had to deal with this issue. And before the tourism in Indaba, they also made promises, because obviously that was going to be the conversation at the Indaba. 24 months later, still no solution, there is no will. Because we have to believe what we see. There is no change.
What change do you think we could institute?
I believe, first and foremost, we should finalize the visa issue immediately so that it is easier for people from anywhere else in the world to come. Remember, Arabile, this is a highly, highly competitive economic sector where all countries are using tourism as a means to diversify their economy. So this is a highly competitive economy. And to make it worse, Arabile, we are at the southern tip of Africa. Mm. In other words, from a geographic perspective, we're at a disadvantage. So we must make it as easy as possible for people to come to our beautiful land. And these two players at government are not doing their job, ladies and gentlemen.
And what else? I mean, look, they said day zero was a big issue and something that needed to be blamed, of course, out of particularly the Western Cape, no water. Should that be seen as, you know what, yes, it makes sense, but we could have prevented it also?
Well, okay, day zero is obviously a mismanagement of planning, load shedding a few years back. But now the day zero has become now a convenient excuse for people to say, no, the decline in tourism is because of day zero. No, they're deflecting attention from the major pertinent issue, which is the visa issue and aviation access.
And why then have we not opened our skies also? The likes of Zimbabwe doing it, really benefiting from arrivals as well.
I definitely think our government enjoys to see poverty. I've come to that realization. Our government, whenever they see the poverty that is impacted the majority of our citizens, to them it's a form of entertainment, because if it was a current government, it would have long opened the skies and benefited with more arrivals and more jobs. Remember, for every 8,000 indigenous tourists that come to South Africa, one permanent job is created. And tourism is a no-brainer. It is easy to create jobs out of this sector. As to why government is supporting this sector, I do not know.
How much engagement have you had, perhaps, with government regarding this? Or, do you think that all the stakeholders are at the table in order to help the situation?
I engage with government possibly every week on tourism issues. And you must also understand there's also the Tourism Business Council, which is also the corporate voice of the tourism sector, which talks to government on a day-to-day basis. So I believe the issue which is lacking is political will.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time there. So Nobile Henama from the Tshwane University of Technology, as we talk about the decrease in tourism arrivals in South Africa, some of the reasons as to why that is currently happening. Thank you so much for your time. It's 20 past the hour. Your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
At 7:22, the Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi released two bills yesterday that paved the way for sweeping reforms to the healthcare system. But it's likely to start a heated debate with private sector providers over what is a fair rate for their services. And to talk to us more about it is Graham Anderson, who's the CEO of ProfMed. Graham, thank you so much for your time this morning. What was your initial assessment of what you read in the Gazette?
Good morning, and good morning to your listeners. I think the whole industry has been taken aback quite a bit, because at the Polokwane conference of the ruling party about 10 years ago, they brought out a white paper which had a number of issues in it which were very worrying to the private sector, because what they want to do in that white paper is to close down the private sector and just have national health insurance. There were lots of comments and discussions around that, and subsequently to that, about 4 years ago, they published a green paper which contained a lot of the suggestions that we put forward to the minister. But from what I can gather, these bills were published last year, and I haven't answered them. But from what I gather, the minister.
We seem to have.
Sorry,
Graham, we were just having some technical issues with you, but they seem to be sorted. You can continue talking.
So the new bill was published, and what I heard from the minister yesterday when he was talking, and we haven't had time to go through them yet because they were only published late yesterday, is that they've gone back to what wanted to do about 10 years ago, and that is to close the private sector down virtually, and you only have NHS. With the situation we have at the moment, where the public sector is in such a mess and the private sector is holding its own, it's not perfect. I don't think any healthcare in the world system in the world is perfect, but it is holding its own, and he wants to close that down almost completely and just have the NHI in the long run, from what I can gather from what he said yesterday. And I think that that's a very dangerous situation, because we're going to start losing our healthcare professionals. They'll move out and go and practice their professions elsewhere.
Right. I've heard various, people talk about it, either whether they're for it or against it, but majority, have been against it, not in the sense that they don't think it's a good thing to do, but in the sense that they feel that the way it will be built won't work, and that, there are hospitals that are inadequate, and you want to be able to fix all of that before you bring in a system that can be complicated. The one concern that I do want to ask you about is something that I read, where somebody says that it is vulnerable to corruption, because what you're essentially doing is that you are giving the minister the power to nominate, appoint and remove board members, which are functions that should not vest in just one individual. Is that something that you're concerned about?
Yes. I think, first of all, we need to say that this country is desperate for universal health care. Mm-hmm. I think nobody would argue that. The way that the minister envisages it happening is we're going to have a single payer. So all the money, 150 billion rand a year, will go into one risk pool. And that will be governed by this board that you're talking about, and the ability for corruption to be rampant there, as it is in many of the other state institutions, is very worrying, and I agree with you on that point.
I mean, national healthcare schemes, as you mentioned, they aren't things that are not common. I mean, people do them all around the world, but some of them don't necessarily work in other parts of the world. In Britain, for instance, I've heard of issues where government is currently looking for alternatives to their universal healthcare plan. Should we be concerned that this might not actually work out? I mean, what more do we need to do in order for it to be a success and we can buck the trend when others don't seem to be working it so well?
Universal healthcare is very important all around the world, but universal healthcare has never been public sector only anywhere in the world. Mm. Public sector, in parallel with the private sector, works very well. In fact, if you think about it, if we could get our public sector up and running well, in other words, if the Minister of Health could get the government sector to be running well, and our medical schemes or the private healthcare sector running as it is at the moment, we would in fact have universal healthcare, because those that can't afford medical aid would be able to go to good public health hospitals, but they can't because the public health hospitals are such a mess.
Right. Graham Anderson, thank you so much for your time. That's the CEO of ProfMed giving us his take on the NHI. Hopefully we'll be talking to the Health Minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, a little later on. But Arabile, you have a hot news item that we should be looking at.
Yeah, it's just something else that is obviously making headlines. It's something that has continued for quite some time now. The unions in the issue against Eskom and the wage talks that seem to be going on there. Unions now saying, of course, that Eskom is just wasting people's time, and they actually aren't at the table. They're delaying talks, that the negotiations have again been delayed. The unions, of course, you know, refusing flat out the 4.7% offer on Wednesday that was tabled by Eskom, and instead said we want 9% or nothing. They also demanded an 8.6% increase for 2019 and 8.5% in 2020 as well, and a housing allowance of at least 1,000 rand, with 180 paid maternity leave days too. So those talks seem to be delayed. Just how it's going to impact electricity supply in the country is also going to be quite key.
An article that Antoinette Slabbert has written, and she's a journalist at MoneyWeb, it talks about what Eskom employees really earn. There was a lot of speculation in terms of what the actual figure is, and MoneyWeb has learned that the trade unions represented at Eskom, of course we mentioned, they are demanding 9% salary increase for their members in the first year, and in the second year 8.6 and so on. And you know, the negotiations are taking place at a time when Eskom has run out of cash, as Arabile has alluded to, and its status is as a going concern is put at risk. But have a look at that article. You can find it on MoneyWeb that breaks down the salary scales of Eskom staff who form part of the bargaining unit. And it also showed that these workers earn well before 790,000 rand average annual salary based on numbers disclosed in the Eskom annual report. Some very interesting there. And the highest salary level on the scale in the bargaining unit amounts to 595,000 rand per year,
which is almost 50,000 rand per month as well. So that clearly indicating some of the figures of how much people may earn. But of course, the range is between 11,000, yeah, I think, and 49,000 there. It is 7:30. Let's take a look at your news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
7:31. Introducing virtual reality as a curriculum to learners. How exactly can this help solve current and real life problems? Adi Stephen, who is the head of learning at IQ Business, joins us today. It's a Johannesburg management consultancy firm, and they've partnered with American VR company Oculus Rift to introduce a groundbreaking virtual reality curriculum to South African learners. Adi, thank you so much for joining us this morning. The interesting element here is just how exactly do we plan to use this in order to advance, shall we say, the education sector in the country?
Morning. Good question. And I think as a starting point, I think one needs to understand that the virtual reality component is not there to take anything away from the current curriculum. It's not there to take anything away from the teachers. It's there to actually supplement and add. And what it added, it adds a completely new world that the learner hasn't seen before. Mm. So being able to go places, to experience things that they haven't seen before and that they will potentially not be able to see. So it's supplementing what we've currently got.
Yeah, we're already seeing them grab tablets, you know, and we thought, oh, that's absolutely great. Now to give them virtual reality is even more phenomenal. I remember the first time I put on, a set of virtual reality goggles or glasses and whatnot. And it really is amazing, and it's a really great tool. But how exactly do you use that? How exactly do we hope that, you know, there'll be what, lessons on there? How exactly are we planning to make that work in order to get that educational upliftment?
So we've got a number of lessons. So from a curriculum point of view, you're looking at almost any subject and any topic bar languages where it's very difficult to create some virtual reality content.
Yeah.
But if you're talking physical science, talking geography, etc., you can very easily create content. And the content allows the learner to experience the content. So when you've got the goggles on, you will be able to experience, for example, Newton's first law of motion. You can stand in the cube, you can throw the ball, you can see what happens. And this is what makes it so incredible. Yes, you can look at it on a tablet, but now you're in it, you've got it around you, and you can try, you can experience, you can do, learning by doing.
Yeah. Barriers to entry and adoption in South Africa are quite huge. However, nothing more so than costings. You know, to put this at a large scale and perhaps, you know, take it out to as many South African schools as possible is a big deal. Funding is going to be an issue.
So I think virtual reality and specifically the devices have come a long way. So way back when, you had to have a laptop, you had to have the device, you had to spend half an hour setting up your sensors and everything.
Yeah.
And the device was quite costly as well. Now, Oculus and some of the other providers have released virtual reality headsets, which are no longer connected to a laptop. You're no longer connected as such. You're completely mobile. From a cost point of view, the cost has come down significantly as well. So all of a sudden, the technology, it's easy to set up, so anybody can put the headset on, you need your phone, you download the content, and you're there. It's very easy to start with virtual reality in a classroom. It's no longer complicated and not costly. I mean, the headset, you're looking at about between six and 8,000 rand for a headset.
Sure. And then at the same time, integrating it into the education system is going to be quite key. How do you plan on doing that, and how long is that rollout, do you reckon, going to take?
So I think integrating it will take understanding and what we've seen now, acceptance by teachers as well. So it creates a new dynamic into the classroom. So let's remember way back when we had cell phones, we had tablets, we had other technology that came in. How can we use that? And with VR, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
How can we take the VR component and how can we make it part of the classroom? So it needs to be integrated, and the integration will slightly depend on the type of environment and school and how many devices does a specific classroom have. Now, there was a movie a while back, Ready Player One, quite interesting, where schooling was taking place with a headset on, and you port into this virtual world. Integrating it into the classroom will be slightly different. Does everybody have a device? Then it's quite easy.
Yeah.
Where the teacher will go and say, okay, everybody, let's put our headsets on and let's together travel to the Grand Canyon, or let's go to the Great Wall of China. If you've only got one device in a class, it's still not impossible to get people to, for example, split into groups and you do some group work while you're giving one person the chance to experience this in virtual reality.
Yeah. Also then what becomes difficult is the adaptation process from government and the education department, how do they then see this and say to themselves, actually, this is absolutely necessary? And with the funding restraints we're seeing in the country, who then begins to fund that process? Because clearly then, you know, it has to come from somewhere too.
I think for me, the best part is always going out to a school and seeing how the learners actually react, okay? Getting a student to put the headset on and letting them go, letting them experience this, and then seeing the joy. And sometimes also, depending on what type of journey, there's some, in history, there's some journeys that actually make people very sad. People get emotional. People, all of a sudden, they understand. And once you see that, and I think normally if you see the learners experiencing this, then the teachers say, wow, okay. People completely climb out of their shell.
Yeah.
And once you see that, I think from a funding perspective, and once you can see the impact this will have, I think funding can be found.
Yeah. At the same time, you did mention this earlier, that it's not meant to replace teachers. It's meant to obviously enhance the experience as well. How do you convince teachers, though, who perhaps are a little old school, to perhaps, you know, form a part of this process and really add this to their curriculum?
I think there's nothing like experiencing it. So once you put the headset on, and you actually see it and experience it and have somebody talking to you and you get involved in this virtual world, I think the teachers are sold. Then it's not a question if, it's a question when. Can we have it?
Yeah. Looking forward to it. Addie, thank you so much for the time. Addie Stevens is head of learning at IQ Business, really talking about how virtual reality can be added to the curriculum for learners as well. I think it's a very, very interesting way to educate, and perhaps different ways to create, really create a good curriculum for students as well.
Something not related to the curriculum of students, but interesting nonetheless, and you can find it on theverge.com. If you know rapper or musician Akon, he plans to build his own Senegal and launch his own cryptocurrency that'll be a central form of exchange. Look at Arabile giving me that look. Yes, it's going to be called an A-coin. Get it?
Oh, no.
Yes, and the business plan says Akon Crypto City plans on cryptonizing our daily human and business exchanges. So he's trying to, he says here in his announcement that he's going to be bringing his own real-life Wakanda, referring to the ultra-high-tech fiction nation ruled by King T'Challa from Black Panther.
Does he know that the price of Bitcoin has now dropped to around 6,000, having went really high to 20,000 odd at some stage?
Maybe an A-coin would interesting. Work.
An A-coin.
Yes.
Really, it sounds like an A-coin. But anyway, it's 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Your traffic, rather.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's 7:31 and we're going to be having our entrepreneurship feature right now with Jacques Tosmos, the founder of Open. It's a newly developed access management app that allows users to make any gate, garage or door smart without changing the door lock or motors. So it's so smart you won't even have to forget your keys, and Jacques's on the line to talk to us about it. Thank you so much for your time, Jacques. This is a fantastic idea. I mean, you're saving many a person that has been locked out of their homes or misplaced their keys. How did the idea come together?
Morning. Yeah, it was just from personal frustration, really, of having forgotten keys and having to turn around to go and fetch them from someone and then just do the same journey all over again. So just from personal frustration that we started out, and now it's really morphed into something that can help a lot of people.
How does it work?
So there's obviously an app interface, and we have a small Internet of Things device that we connect to the garage door or the motor of the gate and things, and that just sends signals to say open or close. And what we've then developed with that is a sensor technology that you can tell whether the gate or the door or the garage is open or closed.
All right. What's your background, Jacques? I mean, that led up to coming with an idea like this. Is it an IT background? How did it all work out?
No, not at all. That's always the funny thing. You know, I'm an architect by trade, and I work within that space overseas. It was just a frustration. I said, listen, there must be a solution. And I contacted a friend that knew something about IT, and we started out. And it just grew from that little by little.
And do you think that, you know, South Africans will adapt to it? I mean, you mentioned that you're not making anything new. It's just existing GSM technology that's become more user-friendly.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of people already phone their gate to open. They use SMS to switch on the alarm and switch it off again. So, I mean, that's the base of the technology. It's the same thing. We've just really made the app more intuitive, and it's easy to invite your friends or give your domestic worker access, or to Airbnb guests that you can easily send invites for the time they've booked. So, I mean, and everybody uses apps. So it's really nothing new, and we've found some great traction already in the market. So that's good. So people definitely use it and they find the value of it.
All right. What are some of the security risks of using this app, if any?
Yeah, so there will always be risk in internet things that someone can hack a system and things. So we obviously mitigate that through secure communication through all our channels, and we've made our password system quite strong, so someone can't just hack your password and things like that easily. So with that, we try to mitigate it. But I mean, it's just as easy for someone to steal your keys or copy your remote or something like that. At least now you'll get notification to say someone is entering and things like that. So there's a lot more control in it, that you know when something is opened.
Yeah. Jacques, what's next for you? What are some of the plans that you have for the future, or something that you want to be working on in association with the, you know, the open network?
Yes, we're always dreaming, and I remain an innovator at heart. So we're looking at bringing in an alarm system with the thing, so that if the door is opened at a certain time, we'll actually make an automated call to your cell phone, so you can know someone has entered the property. We're looking at a intercom system for communities, so that someone can just phone a number and they route it through to the tenant or the owner, and then they can open the gate and things like that. So all community management system that we'll be launching later this year, which we're very excited about.
How long did it take you, just to go back a little bit, how long did it take you to, you know, for all of this to come together? I mean, and the planning stage and trying and testing it out?
Yeah, so I mean, we started, really, the frustration happened last year, mid-January, so that's 2017, and we started about 2 weeks later. We actually had our first working testing thing, and I could open from overseas someone's gate. So our first testing was 2 weeks. It was very basic, and from there we actually just added a little bit of functionality, a better app interface, a little bit of that, and we grew as we go. And we launched the 31st of July in Cape Town with a bunch of industry people there, and there was some great traction, and people could use the system. So so about 18 months.
All right, Jacques. Well, thank you so much for your time and all the best. That's Jacques Talsma, who is the founder and CEO of Open, which is a South African app that makes any door smart so you don't have to forget your keys.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Before we get into our next conversation, of course, we are still trying to get the minister, the health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, on the line as well. We seem to be struggling with that line, but hopefully we will get him up and just give another chat on that national health insurance bill, which was gazetted and announced yesterday. But very quickly as well, things happening today. We did see CPI and the current account data come out this week as well. But today, Gary, seems to be another busy one. International front, we have OPEC locally, there's still NASPER. So still quite something to look forward to in the market.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a busy close to the week. So yeah, NASPER, I think the results are due out about 3 p.m. today.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting because I think everyone's, you know, certainly in our office anyway, is of the opinion that Tencent is a fantastic investment, and you've got, you know, very good sight into that. But it's going to be how the rump businesses are performing. They have changed the way that they, you know, the accounting treatment at the moment. So you're going to see, you know, very difficult to compare numbers. You're going to have to really go through them with a fine-tooth comb. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly going to be interesting to see how the likes of DStv are performing and you know, what kind of pressures that's putting on the, at least the local entry into Tencent, because there's no question that you know, institutional and retail investors are certainly heavily overweight Naspers because of the weighting in the index. And I think everyone's very, very nervous to exit from it in portfolios. But they're all looking for that Tencent exposure. So the rum businesses really are key. And I think with the kind of investments that they've made recently, these are going to take time to come to fruition, to actually see the earnings growth. So definitely it's going to be one to watch. And I think there could be a lot of volatility around the number.
Heavy reading certainly out of for the weekend as well to take a look at those earnings. But at the same time, OPEC meeting, it's $73 odd for a barrel right now. I think many would have expected it to be higher.
I think it could still be high. So looking at it, I think the market's definitely expecting, an announcement out of probably Saudi Arabia and Russia, joint announcement that they will be increasing production. And I think we need it desperately. So it's going to come down to the quantum. And I put on Twitter earlier today that anything less than 700,000 barrels a day increase, I think you're going to see oil prices spike on the back of that. And that's because at the moment you've got real supply constraints. You've got... the U.S. Shale is almost bottlenecked at the moment with the development of pipelines. You've got supply coming out of the market from some OPEC countries, the likes of Venezuela, Libya, Iran as well, potentially. So, we're in a very tight oil market. At the same time, we've got China and India voicing concerns about the higher oil price. And you're getting solid demand from those two economies. And that all points to a higher oil price in the short term. You have had Russia and Saudi Arabia. So Russia said that they think that they need an increase of about 1.5 million barrels a day. The Saudi oil minister saying about 1 million barrels a day. So it's all to play for this evening on the announcement. We're going to see what happens. If we get a significantly larger increase in production, you might see oil prices starting to drift back down. The big banks still have targets around sort of $55-$60 a barrel. We know that the head of BP is also targeting that kind of level for oil. So they're seeing oil weakness, but it's all going to come down to the meeting this weekend.
Look, man, more production just means a cheaper price, which means that we don't have to pay so much for fuel here in South Africa, hopefully, and the rand just keeps as stagnant as it could be. So that's ultimately the South African hope, and I think that's the only South African story that matters at present, hopefully. So we'll see what happens on that front.
All right, it's 7:51. The 2018 Deloitte Millennial Survey found that millennials are disillusioned and uneasy, and companies seem to be failing miserably at bridging the generational gap in the workforce currently. To talk to us about it is Rob Jardine, who's the head of research and solutions at the Neuro Leadership Institute of South Africa. Rob, thank you so much for your time. I mean, how do you inspire millennials, to be loyal through continuous learning opportunities?
Hi, good morning. I think the first thing that we have to remember about the South African millennials is that they're not any different from the global millennials, in that they really feel pessimistic about the future and pessimistic about the role companies are playing in preparing them for the future. So one thing that we really need to focus on is to focus on creating an environment of lifelong learning within corporates to better engage and sustain their loyalty over time as both their roles change and the market changes.
Right. I mean, you don't even need to do research for this. I mean, individuals growing up during different times in society possess different worldviews. And this can also, have an impact in the workplace and when it comes to values and preferences. How do you bridge that gap so that either you or the millennial, in your office or around you are on the same page every now and again when it comes to, performance, etc.?
Well, here's the thing. Generations have existed for millennia, but recent breakthroughs in neuroscience have shown us that the more you focus on difference, the more you further isolate people from an in-group and an out-group. So the key is not really focusing on what do millennials want.
Yeah.
It is what includes all of us into the conversation. What do we all have in common?
You talk about the growth mindset, saying that it can be a differentiator for employers. Talk to me about that.
So the growth mindset relates to another breakthrough in neuroscience and focuses on the fundamental belief in your ability. Do you believe your ability is finite and capped, or do you believe your ability can be grown and developed? If you have a growth mindset, you believe your ability can be grown and developed, and therefore moving into an environment that is constantly changing, where there's a constant need to learn, a growth mindset helps you perform and focus on developing skills and attributes that will be relevant in this changing future that we're now a part of.
Speaking of that changing future, I mean, we talk constantly about the fourth industrial revolution and various other things that are in that space. How do you then put growth mindset and the fourth industrial revolution and all these exciting changes that are taking place together so that companies are prepared and millennials are excited?
Well, the first thing we have to do is appreciate that our current education system that we were talking about earlier on the show and our environment has created a fixed mindset where we are socialized to prove ourselves, displace and show up at work. But a growth mindset focuses on what we reward and how we recognize people for developing skill and recognizing improvement. So one of the best things that we can do right now is to simply add the word yes to many of our statements. I'm not good at this presentation yet. Mm. You didn't make a good sales call yet. Focusing on our language is very powerful from a neuroscience perspective to reshape mindset and recreate reality to focus on growth and improvement and not displaying and proving ourselves in the workplace.
When it comes to millennials, I'm sure you've read plenty of reports that talk about them. What are some of the misconceptions we have about our millennials?
I think the biggest misconceptions actually relate to my thesis research that mm-hmm. I recently completed in the South African context.
Yeah.
And the biggest misconception that we may have is that we are different to everyone else. They are the largest population. Okay, of a generation that's ever existed, and the first global population. And one of the biggest perceptions is that they are narcissistic and all the negative stuff that really sells popular press and newspapers, right? The generation me. But at the end of the day, this generation and the next generation, Generation Z, are growing up in the times of the most economic uncertainty that has ever existed. The top 100 companies that were listed 20 years ago, only 10% exist today.
Mm.
Just look at some of the companies like Basil Reed last week, for example. Companies are shutting down and closing, and new industries are being disrupted. So when millennials and Generation Z focus on job hopping and looking for the next job, it's not necessarily they're looking out for themselves and being disloyal. They're trying to survive in a very uncertain economic context. And if we can provide economic security to these kind of generations that grow up in uncertainty, we may be better able to keep them in their roles for long term.
All right, Rob, thanks so much for your time. That's Rob Jardine, who's the head of research and solutions at the Neuro Leadership Institute of South Africa, talking to us about inspiring loyalty amongst millennials in the workplace.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It is just around 4 minutes to the top of the hour. Quick other news that's also making headlines today. The acting South African Revenue Services Commissioner, Mark Kingan, of course, his term was extended for another 90 days recently, says he wants to see SARS increase its collection by 20%. And key to doing that is effective service and enforcing perceptions that there is a real risk to non-compliance. So, of course, how do you make South Africans then understand that taxpayers need to, in essence, continue to pay their taxes? And even though there was a sense of people not wanting to comply, the effective service of SARS needs to get back to where it was and certainly increase again. Kingon believing as well that reconfiguring how SARS processes its dealings with big business in particular may indeed be a key driver of how to hike tax revenue as well. So he's hoping to run this project and make it quite successful and give our tax collections an impetus boost of 20%.
Here's a question that I have. We've all read the different books relating to state capture,
yeah,
or what was thought to be a rogue unit, which turned out not to be an actual rogue unit. I wonder if we're going to be resetting up all those structures again that were, you know, trying to, you know, track down people who were doing illicit tobacco trading,
yeah,
or because that can actually help us in being able to get back on track and achieve that 20% that he actually wants.
Indeed, and perhaps doing it in another way. It may not have to happen the exact same,
yeah,
way it was in the past, but maybe a little more stringent. You see the flaws in it. You see how it failed the last time and what the big problems were. So perhaps looking at how you can do that a little bit better. The likes of Brazil seeing their tax revenue increased by 17%, and Mark Kingan saying he's very unhappy that we're lagging behind. And even though India has a growth rate of 7.5% in its tax revenue. At the same time, I wanted to check and take a look at the price of gold. It's still hovering below $1,300 a fine ounce, but it is steady and hitting a six-month trough, in the previous session as well. The US dollar pulling back from what is almost a one-year high as well. And that's just on profit booking. Gary still joining us in studio. Gary, the price of gold itself, another fall, at least of around 1% this week as well. So it's going to be a big deal for the price of gold lately.
Yeah, so a couple of analysts scratching their heads around the fall in gold, because I think you've certainly seen the elevation of geopolitical risks, and that's, and traditionally gold does behave like a safe haven. I think the explanation behind it is just the rising interest rate path in developed economies. So when you've got higher rates on US treasuries, they act as a safe haven as well, except you do get a small yield off it, whereas gold obviously gives you no yield. So as a safe haven investment, as interest rates rise, gold becomes less and less attractive to hold, at least in size. But it's an interesting note out by RBC Capital that kind of trying to dispel that myth, saying that in a rising interest rate environment, gold's relationship is actually asymmetrical as well. And if you do get a real fear returning to the market, you will see gold doing very, very well. And at the moment, I think we're kind of feeling jitters around the trade war. We're feeling perhaps jitters going into the North Korean summit a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't enough to really get gold moving. And at this stage, gold's slipping, but it's a hedge. It's not something that you put in a portfolio to generate large returns. It's something that you put in a portfolio to smooth out your performance. It's to be your one counter that is counter to everything else.
Fantastic. Gary Boyson, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Sadly, we didn't get the health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, on the line. We did keep trying. We'll hopefully keep trying as well for Monday, Tash, and get that conversation going, just exactly how he plans to also help fund the NHI, which is quite significant as well. But next up, of course, we have the world's most beautiful music with Peter Terry, continuing your morning as a Classic Business Breakfast ends for the week. We'll see you on Monday.
Goodbye.